Hello and welcome to yet another episode of the Saxo Market Call podcast. And today it is our thematic episode, and I'm very happy to share with you that for the second time this week, Charu Chanana is joining us from Singapore. Hi, Charu. How are you doing?
Hi, Soren. I can't be better. Yeah, second hit with you this week. What's better than that?
I just love that comment. I think I'll share that everywhere I can. But today, Charu, the reason why you're here is that we're going to talk about basically what has been the talk of the town this week, which is this Bank of Japan rate hike out of negative interest rates earlier this week, because it is significant for a host of reasons. And one of the reasons is the economic history of Japan, which is one of the things that we're going to dive into today. Just have a look at why is this significant and what has it been for the past, I guess, 25 to 30 years is what we're gonna discuss. Obviously, some of it is gonna be more now focused with the economic outlook, the market impact, and JPY. Obviously, you're also, apart from being a macro expert, also our FX expert. So we're also gonna talk about the yen because there is a strong connection between the stock market and the currency markets when we talk Japan. And then we're going to look ahead and see what's in store from here on out for Japan, because Japan is a super interesting case. So why don't we just get started? And I think just to set the base level, could you let us in on what it is that happened on Tuesday with Bank of Japan and what did they say and do?
Sure. So let's start there. So, I mean, really, it is a new era for Japan, for the Bank of Japan, where they have scrapped years of negative interest rate policy. So it's they've changed this after 17 years. So their short-term interest rate was at minus 0.1%, and they've moved it higher now to 0 to 0.1%. They've also scrapped their yield curve control policy. I don't want to go into the technical details there, but these Japanese authorities had this stiff control around where the long end yields can also go. So factually, yes, they have scrapped that policy now. And they have said that they're going to stop ETF purchases as well. So certainly this was a very, very orthodox policy. And we are moving out of it after several decades. So certainly a very new landscape kicking off for Japan here.
Yeah, that's and I mean it is more or less just a 10 basis point a hike. So why right now is it important for Japan to do this, do you think?
I mean, why it is important is just because of the way the economy has developed. Particularly because we are coming from a point where the economy faced three straight decades of deflation. There was back-to-back years when Japan's price growth has been negative. We've come a little bit away from that in the last couple of years, where, initially it was on the back of higher food and energy prices and a weak Japanese yen that kind of fueled some inflationary pressures in Japan. But at this point, from what the Bank of Japan says, they are looking at these inflationary pressures to be a little bit more durable because they are translating into wage gains. So what we saw last week was that the wage negotiations for some of the larger labor unions in Japan concluded with a very strong wage growth being agreed for the next fiscal year. The magnitude there is 5.28%, which is huge for a country where borrowing costs are still close to zero. And, this is the highest wage growth that they've again seen in three decades. So this is a marked change for Bank of Japan and for the Japanese economy. And this is what has really given them the confidence to kind of exit their orthodox policy after many, many years.
All right, yeah, that is, as you say, many, many years. And I think with those words in mind, I think we should move into the historical context and why this is significant. And I think one of the points that I at least had been thinking about for this topic is that also due to the fact that Japan has struggled with its growth for so many years, people probably tend to sleep on the fact that Japan is still one of the biggest economies in the world. I mean, it's depending on how you measure it and how a year unfolds, it is between the third and the fifth largest economy measured on GDP. And it's also been a peculiar case because, as I said, their inability to create growth. And I think, obviously, that's a topic we could spend a lot of time on in itself. But could you highlight just some of the things that's been specific for Japan, because it has been so much different than the other big economies around the globe?
Yeah, I mean, I would say certainly Japan has had a number of challenges to, you know, deal with in the last 30 years, from being an aging society where, you know, the demographics have meant that the workforce, the size of the workforce is shrinking, to high debt and, you know, lack of innovation, lack of productivity, particularly if you kind of measure it against US, which has progressed so much in the last 30 years. You know, Japan still seems to be lagging behind in a big way. And a lot of that is still there. You can't get rid of the debt issues or the demographics in a short span of time. But really, the big issue, like I mentioned before, has been the one of deflation. So between 1960 and the late 1980s, Japan's economic growth was actually double that of the US. But then in 1989, there was a stock market crash. There was a banking crisis as well in Japan. And ever since then, inflation has remained low in Japan. It turned into deflation in the 2000s and again during the pandemic years as well. So why this deflation really, I would say, marks the big economic story for me in terms of Japan's history is because with deflation comes that, you know, the growth downside that you just mentioned. So there is lack of domestic demand, and it's a cycle. There's less demand means there's less inflation, which means that companies cannot pass through price increases. So they have to absorb much of the changes in the prices of raw materials and stuff. So profit margins have been weak. So investments have been weak and, you know, capital spending has been weak. And that's why, you know, you see this lack of productivity and lack of innovation also, as I've been saying. And that's exactly what is contributing overall to weak growth for many, many years. There's been this trap that the Japanese economy has been, which for me, it starts from deflation, but of course, it's a circle, you can say, wherever it starts. But, you know, yeah, they've been just stuck in this weak inflation, weak wages, and then that leading to really no demand and less growth overall.
Yeah, and I think I don't know if there's any correlation, but sort of around the COVID years of 2020, it seemed like we've seen Japan kind of normalizing in terms of achieving a little bit more growth and inflation and getting to a more normal level. Which I guess essentially is the reason why they now feel that they can leave this negative rate environment.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, it started on the back of those higher food and energy prices, which were driven by, yes, the pandemic issues, and then the weak Japanese yen as well, which kind of amplified these price pressures at that point. But now inflation has been above 2% target for Japan for 22 months in a row, which is obviously a pretty long time. And more importantly, those price increases seem to have broadened out. You know, you would see, if you look at the CPI, the details of Japan, even services prices are starting to accelerate quite sharply there. Again, that's been driven by a huge demand for inbound tourism into Japan because the Japanese yen has been very weak. So you've seen these high rail fares, high delivery fees, restaurant prices, all of them are climbing higher. And that is kind of, yes, now I would say theoretically it is reversing the virtuous cycle where we talked about wages, the wage negotiations that happened last week, and we've got the early results with 5.28% wage growth being agreed. So wages are increasing, and that gives more confidence that consumer spending will start to rise from here. And again, that will be that will flow into greater confidence for the companies to go ahead with price increases as well. So that potentially that positive feedback loop has started because of those price pressures that we saw during the pandemic years.
Yeah, and if we look at that, what sort of judging on that we've seen this positive feedback loop, pulling out, like increasing the rates as they've just done, to some extent, I guess that threatens it a little bit, doesn't it?
I mean, I heard your podcast with Peter as well yesterday on the equities, right? And I think he made a very good point about the tightening cycles, right? It's a very fundamental understanding that usually the early part of a tightening cycle, that is more indicative of economic strength. And it's only when the tightening goes a little bit further that economic weakness really starts to be a concern. How those high borrowing costs will start to weaken the economy, that starts to be a concern. And just again, going back where we started, the Bank of Japan's tightening has been very, very modest, right? We're just up at 0% or 0 to 0.1%. I don't even think that the short-term interest rates will actually go to that upper bound of plus 0.1%. But even if they do, it's just very, very modest increase. And there is no indication that this will be an aggressive tightening cycle by any means. In fact, from the meeting that was held where the Bank of Japan really exited these negative interest rates, there was actually no indication as to what the next move could look like, when it could come. So this is not a rapid tightening cycle. And then overall, the conditions in Japan are still very, very accommodative. If you look at interest rates, like I said, you know, still 0%, maybe 0.1%. Inflation is at 2%, which means that real rate is still well into the negative territory. So this move is not a concern at this point. It is, in fact, a signal that the authorities think that Japan's economy can really withstand non-negative interest rates. And especially if you get that positive feedback loop going, then there is, at this point, you know, there is no reason to believe that growth will be curbed. Unless, of course, I mean, the big risk for Japan really comes from a global recession. If we do see a global recession, Japan will be highly exposed to that, given it is such an export-oriented economy. But in terms of the Bank of Japan policy in itself, I don't see that being restrictive by any means, really.
Okay, and let's just stay with it for a little bit, because you say the Bank of Japan policy has been very accommodative, and you wrote an article about this, all of the tools that the Bank of Japan has been using, and I can only encourage people to go in and read that at home.saxo and go to Inspiration and find your great piece there, or on the platform, of course, if you are a client, then you'll also be able to find it there. But yeah, as you say, with the Bank of Japan scrapping these, as you call them, orthodox policies, it is starting to raise the rates, and it doesn't really raise any concerns, in your opinion, that the economy can slow down again, just like I spoke with Peter about yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, you know, unless of course this turns out to be a concern in terms of inflation, you know, like for most economies over the last 2 years, we've seen inflation being a real problem, because that has been a reason for them to pull back on spending, you know, in pull back in consumption. But in Japan, it's so far that is not a concern. In fact, inflation, Japan is the only economy where inflation is good news for now. And as long as that stays, we don't see a reason for Bank of Japan to really go ahead in a big way with this tightening cycle. There's also a lot of debt sustainability concerns that I mentioned in those articles that you've been referring to. There's a lot of fiscal concerns as well. You know, there's really a lack of JGB market, the market for Japanese government bonds, because all of them are, or actually 40-50% of them are really bought by the Bank of Japan. So if they were to increase rates aggressively, then the interest burden of the Bank of Japan goes up, and also the debt risks for the Japanese government go up. So there are a lot of things that I've discussed in those articles there, reasoning that why the Bank of Japan policy will unlikely be, you know, aggressive, and that makes me, it just, for me, for now, it just gives me a more positive signal on the economy than really a negative signal.
Okay, so if we're just trying to recap the historical backdrop, for 25 to 30 years, Japan has been struggling with creating inflation and thereby also growth, but during the pandemic years, we managed to see some wage increases that have now led them to be able to raise interest rates, which we don't really see as a risk, but more as a positive signal from the Bank of Japan, who has left these orthodox policies behind and are starting to, hopefully, for Japan at least, see a normalizing economy. Is that sort of the shortest conclusion we can make on this bit of the podcast, Charu?
Yeah, bang on, Soren.
That's good. Because then I think we should move on to the economic outlook and look a little bit ahead to what this then matters for the markets, because really that is also very interesting. And I think, as I said in the beginning, you are very much into FX, and I think JPY, the Japanese yen, has probably been the most interesting, or at least most in focus, currency this year, and obviously this, I assume at least, would have an impact on that too. But what's your take on the Japanese yen related to the Bank of Japan announcement?
I mean, certainly the reaction function has been counterintuitive. So even though this was a rate hike from the Bank of Japan, we did see the Japanese yen weakening rather than strengthening on the report. Now, that was not really a surprise, I would say. I mean, and the reason is that because the rate hike did come with a lot of dovish caveats, you know, like they said that policy will remain accommodative. And like I said, there was no visibility on what future rate hikes could look like. So it seems to be, as of now, a one and done, which was obviously, it wasn't really a hawkish message. And the whole move from the Bank of Japan was very well priced in, because we saw a number of Japanese media houses really reporting the exact same measures that the Bank of Japan took for some days in advance of the actual announcement. So the markets had really priced that in quite well. Now, what that means in terms of the Japanese yen from here, so right now, as we speak today, it's a Wednesday, 20th of March, and the dollar yen has been rising. It's above 150, 150, the last time I checked in before coming in to speak with you, Soren, which means that the Japanese yen has still been weakening. And why is that so? It's because when you look at dollar yen, it is really a play on the yield differentials between the US bonds, the treasuries, and the Japanese government bonds. And with the Fed rate is about 5.5%. And even with this BOJ raising rates now from minus 0.1% to say plus 0.1%, the gap between these two, the 5.5% and the near 0%, let me say that, that gap doesn't really close with whatever the Bank of Japan has done, right? And even if you consider the forward pricing for Bank of Japan, we have about 40 basis points of additional tightening that is priced in for the Bank of Japan for the next 2 years. That's very, very modest, even if we were to get that. So, I mean, that doesn't really move the needle on this yield differential that the Japanese government bonds have to the treasuries. Now, the gap only closes when the Fed starts to cut rates, because potentially the Fed's rate cut cycle will be a lot more aggressive. If you see, you know, 100 basis points of cuts maybe in the next 1 year, that really means that, yeah, we come down from 5.5% to 4.5%. So that is really closing the gap in a more aggressive way than anything that the Bank of Japan can do, really. So the fate of the yen really remains in the hands of Fed, in the hands of Chair Powell, not in the hands of Bank of Japan or Governor Ueda, I would say. Now, in the current context, does that mean that the yen could weaken further from here at the level I mentioned, like I saw before coming in, was 150, 150? So there is a risk that Japanese authorities could intervene in the markets at levels like this. About anything above 150, 151 starts to be a little bit of a risky zone for, you know, entering into new trades if you want to be kind of long dollar yen, because the Japanese authorities have a tendency to intervene in the FX markets and try to strengthen the yen if the weakness is getting very, very far. And we've seen that in the last 2 years or so as well. So certainly because of risk of intervention, I would not be, you know, excessively positioning myself for weakening of the yen at this point. But there is also no reason to support a recovery of the yen for now, like I said, right? Despite the fact that it's very weak, despite the fact that the short positioning in the Japanese yen is extremely stretched, the only way the yen can really recover is when the Fed embraces a clear dovish tilt, or, you know, if we do start to see some US data or more broadly indicating, you know, weakness and kind of missing the estimates. That's what I'll be watching. I think that is a driver of yen strength particularly. But for now, for me, I think dollar yen really just remains a buy on dips. So if you see a recovery in Japanese yen, I would think traders rush into the markets to kind of you know, position for more yen weakness again and again until we stay around that 150, 151 area.
Okay, so the short story is that there's still some interest depending on how the yen develops, and that will be more related to the Fed policies. Obviously, as you say, we're recording this European time Wednesday morning, and later today, this evening, we will have the Fed meeting. Although we don't really expect a lot to come from there, but it'll of course be something to look out for, and we will be smarter very soon. I know that I spoke to Peter about the Nikkei yesterday as well, because he is our equity guy. But I would like your take on it too. What's your view on the Nikkei in relation to this announcement from the Bank of Japan?
Right. The interesting thing about Nikkei, and you mentioned that before, Soren, is that the performance has been very highly correlated to the Japanese yen as well. I would say inversely correlated, you know. So the weaker the Japanese yen, the stronger the Nikkei performs usually. And then again, yesterday, I would say it was a little bit of a surprise to see Nikkei closing higher by 0.7%. By yesterday, I mean the day when the Bank of Japan really announced that policy pivot. So we still saw Nikkei pretty stable, a little bit higher, in fact, on that day. But that's, again, because the announcement was overall dovish and it was so well telegraphed and the Japanese yen still was weak, right? So that kind of explains the move. Now, the macro story for Japanese equities from here like Peter mentioned in yesterday's podcast, is that, you know, of course, when the yen starts to strengthen, there is risk that the Japanese, the equities could start to weaken from there. But as long as the fundamentals of the US economy stay robust and the Fed stays clear of a dovish tilt, if it does, like you said, today they are meeting, then I would say that Japanese equities may have some room to build up on their recent gains still, particularly because, again, the yen outlook isn't changing. So that's a key factor. But I wrote an article on this today as well, and I've been talking to a few clients as well. And I think the interesting bit here is that even if the macro story around Nikkei starts to be a little bit less supportive, what is important is that there are some structural tailwinds that have really helped Japanese stocks in the last 1 year. And I don't see a reason why that would reverse. So I can see the story shifting a little bit from, being a top-down, broad story to being a bottom-up stock selection kind of story, where you kind of, stick with names that are more closely tied to those corporate reforms that are going on in the Japanese economy, more tied to the geopolitical tailwinds that have been playing out for the Japanese economy. You stick with sectors that are more focused on domestic demand rather than export focused, large caps usually in Japan. But I would say overall, my view is that Japan is a market that provides a very good opportunity to diversify away from growth-centric U.S. stocks. And if you have that exposure, Japan really offers defensive, low volatility, and a lot of value exposure. So I think it's a very good diversifier in portfolios.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said in terms of diversification in looking at the Nikkei. And obviously, there will always be the FX bit that you'll need to pay attention to. But obviously you're very, very strong in the APAC region and what's going on over there as well. So I just wanted to ask you, are there any other assets, or maybe actually something I completely forgot to say, is that if you want to check this out more, Charu, once again, you wrote a very, very good article. I think it went out today or the other day, which is called Japan's Exit from Negative Interest Rates. Implications for the economy, yen, and stocks. You can get everything there you need if you want to dig more into this this topic. I think related to that, I think an interesting question is whether there's any other asset classes or any other countries, regions, etc., that are going to be affected by this move from the Bank of Japan.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Soren, because obviously before this Bank of Japan exit really happened, there was this concern around how that can really impact the global bond markets, and because of fears that large amounts of Japanese money has been parked in long-term treasuries or other global bond markets, and that could flow back into Japan if yields in Japan were to go higher. But we've avoided any kind of a turmoil now. And again, the fact is that the magnitude of tightening is still very, very modest. I was reading an article this morning from Reuters, which talked about the magnitude of money that is at stake here. So there's $2.4 trillion of foreign debt that Japan's life insurance companies, pension funds, banks, and trust firms, they collectively hold. So obviously there was this fear that we could see this huge flow of money back into Japan. But these holdings are actually earning Japanese investors something of north of 5%. So that's huge. And, and again, given how modest BOJ's rate increase has been, I don't see any reason for them to kind of get it back home. But that's something that is worth watching and probably also discussing with Althea at some point when you have a thematic podcast on fixed income. But the other interesting story that has been pretty relevant for Asia has been the the divergence between Japan and China, particularly. This divergence has played out really well with China weakening, Japan strengthening. It was, you know, if you look at it from a flow perspective or from the perspective of supply chain shifting, all of that has been supporting Japan and has been weakening China. Now, we might be at a turning point in Japan, yes, but we are also at, looks like we are potentially again also at a turning point in China, where I'm no expert there, but there are some sectors that are starting to do better. There is economic data that is starting to at least look less bad. And if, you know, flows return to China, I think there are just a lot of investors who are just waiting on the sidelines for some good news out of China and to kind of re-enter into those Chinese markets. If those flows kind of return to China, could that in some way impact Japanese equities? That's going to be an interesting correlation to watch if that exists or no. And the other thing is that there's a very stiff export competition between China and Japan. And it's only likely to get stiffer, right, as both of them kind of try to advance on the chip technology and the semiconductor dominance and stuff. So now, as long as the Japanese yen was weak, now China could not let the Chinese yuan strengthen as well, because then that makes Japanese exports more competitive than their own exports, right? But if this whole BOJ pivot could mean that the yen started to strengthen from here, then China, which obviously has ambitions to make yuan a reserve currency as well, they would have more flexibility in trying to strengthen the Chinese yuan. So that's, again, something that would be particularly important to watch, how far China goes in, you know, strengthening its currency. I mean, I would think if there's one place for where these positive rates in Japan could be an important story, that's particularly China. But I'm really curious to see how the divergence between these two kind of plays out from here.
It has for a long time been a very interesting distinction between these two countries, and I'm sure that'll continue with because there is a lot of things happening both in China and Japan these days. So I'm sure that's something that we're gonna pay attention to, and maybe that's a relationship we should look into at another time for a thematic podcast. Charu, I think we've reached a point where I've more or less gotten through what I wanted to talk about in this discussion about the Bank of Japan and the historical context and all of this. Is there anything that I've omitted that you want to put a final word to? Because otherwise, my final question to you would be, if we just look at the landscape out there, what's something you would be interested in looking at in terms of trading or investing, either related to Japan or not, obviously depending on what you feel like?
I mean, that's an interesting one, and since we are talking Japan, I would, you know, maybe pull a Japanese stock for my long-term portfolio. I mean, I think, like I said, there's a lot of opportunity in the, you know, in some specific sectors there. And for me, particularly interesting has been the shifting supply chains in the semiconductor space. So maybe like something like Advantest, because of the whole AI momentum that we still have continuing. And then NVIDIA's launch of Blackwell chips yesterday. I think that bodes really well for Advantest's chip testers as well. And this month, we've seen some pullback in that stock. So I'm looking to add that. But of course, there's risks from yen appreciation, which I'll have to keep a lookout for. Valuation is still quite high as well. So absolutely, this is not an investment advice.
No, of course not. It's not a recommendation. And you always need to check your own risk profile, whether something fits into your portfolio. But Charu, I think we hit a record. I think this is the longest podcast we've ever recorded. So but I also think that the topic merits that. But I think because of that, I think I just want to say thank you so much for coming, Charu, and making us all a little bit smarter today.
Thank you, Soren, for having me.
And then on behalf of Charu, Janana, the Saxo Market Call podcast, everybody here at Saxo, My name is Soren Otto. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back anytime soon. And until then, happy trading.